A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, we gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
American Indian Wars, 21st century style. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. The Thanksgiving holiday celebrates the supposedly peaceful partnership between early European settlers and the natives who lived in America first. But while much of the country sits down to dinner, a very different historical pattern is playing out again near Cannonball, North Dakota. A Native American protest against an oil pipeline has been met with tear gas, water cannons, and rubber bullets. It's aroused attention all over the world. As Jane Fonda plans to serve the protesters' Thanksgiving dinner, can President Obama make a lasting difference? We'll get an update. Later on today's Talking Point, drug addiction and presidential politics in America's heartland. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. As many Americans are enjoying Thanksgiving dinner, Native Americans are still protesting in North Dakota. We'll hear what the holidays will be like for them. On our Talking Point later, in parts of the country ravaged by addiction to opiates and Mexican heroin, Donald Trump rolled up large margins in this month's election. So what's the connection? First, this news update. Donald Trump's nominee for ambassador to the United Nations and his choice to be Secretary of Education are adding a touch of diversity to his early selection. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley will be sent to the UN. Betsy DeVos to the Education Department, once again, if they're confirmed. Nancy Cook is senior reporter for Politico, covering the transition. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first of all about Betsy DeVos. She is a billionaire and head of American Federation for Children. What's that?
Well, it's a group that really pushes for expanding charter schools and also giving people vouchers so that students can attend private schools with taxpayer money. And so she's a huge advocate of school choice, which is something that Trump has said that he's quite interested in. And it really matters for education policy because it shows that he is going to follow down that campaign path that he said he would and really push for much more charter schools.
Not a person, I think, that would be supported by the Teachers Association and other who have been very powerful in education policy.
Exactly. They're really upset by this choice. And the other interesting thing to note is that she's just also a huge Republican donor and philanthropist. She married into the family that founded the Amway Corporation. And so, you know, she and her family gave a lot of money to the Trump campaign. And so one thing that we're watching at Politico is just how much of the cabinet is also made up by extremely wealthy people and or donors.
What about Governor Nikki Haley? She is the child of immigrants from India, now governor of South Carolina.
Yeah, and she was Trump's first female pick for a cabinet position. Obviously she has a pretty good track record as a South Carolina governor, or at least Republicans are very happy with her. She's viewed as a rising star. She adds a lot of diversity to his existing choices. I think the rap on her so far is that she has very little foreign policy experience and no diplomatic experience, and this UN position is really quite a tricky one. You have to negotiate with a lot of key allies, including Russia, and so I think people are really wondering whether or not she has the foreign policy credentials to really do this. Senator Ben Cardin, who's the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has already promised to say that he's really going to question this when she comes before the Senate.
Surprised politically, because, of course, she called Mr. Trump out in January for the kind of language he used and his attitude toward women, and took him to task for his failure to condemn the Ku Klux Klan and other similar kinds of groups. She supported somebody else for president.
Yeah, she supported Senator Marco Rubio. And so it's also an interesting pick because it goes against this whole narrative that I think a lot of people have been really pushing forward, that Trump really supports loyalty or rewards it. And, you know, she wasn't a Trump supporter for most of the campaign. And so this suggests that he's willing to go outside of this loyal group of, band of followers.
And it appears, at least there's a rumor, that Ben Carson may be back in the running.
Yes, and it seems like to run HUD, which is another interesting pick. You know, obviously, he's an extremely well-regarded surgeon, so it did make some sense when Trump, even before the election, said that he really wanted Carson to help out at HHS or on healthcare issues. This, of course, would put Carson running a huge federal agency and a topic that he's not really well-versed in, but he has said that he's interested, so it seems like that announcement could be forthcoming.
Somewhat contradictory. He said he really wasn't qualified to hold that other job. What does all of this tell us about the vetting process that's going on with the transition team?
Well, my colleague Andrew and I wrote a story today just about it, and it does seem like the Trump transition team they've done some initial vetting on some people, particularly they did some vetting when Chris Christie was running the transition. It seems like, though, now the vetting is not quite as thorough as it has been in past administrations for these picks, and it does seem like Trump is really relying on the advice of, you know, friends, colleagues, people on the transition team, lawyers in D.C. for suggestions for his cabinet, and that is really sort of superseding everything. His own picks is the most important thing in terms of who he's selecting.
Apparently, it took him just 5 days to choose a Congressman Mike Pompeo to be head of the CIA. Pretty important job.
Exactly. And that's what we heard from someone inside the transition team. You know, that's a remarkably fast amount of time to pick your CIA director when it's such a key position, requires, you know, so many security clearances. You would think that that person would want to be very, very heavily vetted.
So we don't really know to this point whether he's calling in experts on these various positions or whether he's going with his rather small crowd of supporters who helped him in the campaign.
Yeah, we do know that the final decisions seem to be made by the folks in Trump Tower. And so whether or not he is paying attention to these initial vetting documents, that sort of remains to be seen. And it also remains to be seen, how closely the FBI is working to do the background checks. And what's kind of key about this is that even though people are in the public eye, there's things that can still come up. In the Obama administration, for instance, President Obama nominated Senator Tom Daschle to be the head of HHS, and there ended up being problems with that nomination.
Okay. There have been problems with him and with others as well in past administrations. We'll see what happens this time. Nancy Cook, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much.
In a moment, American Indian Wars, 21st Century Style, on To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Maureen Olney back with To the Point. Thanksgiving originally was designed as a moment to look back to the early days of European settlement and peaceful relations with Native Americans who helped the Pilgrims settle the land and learn how to feed themselves. A very different strain of American history is playing out in Standing Rock, North Dakota, where protesters against an oil pipeline settling in for the winter were met last weekend with tear gas, rubber bullets, and water hoses, despite freezing temperatures. Sandy Tolan is an author and a reporter. He's also a professor at USC's Annenberg School of journalism. He has just left the protest camps near Standing Rock and the Sioux Reservation there in order to get into cell phone range. Sandy, welcome to our program. What did you see today?
Good to be back with you, Warren. Well, I talked to a number of people who were at the clashes on Sunday night and early Monday morning. But before I get into that, I was struck by, I've been here three times now, and I was struck by how much there has been, how much construction there's been. And the population of the camp was probably down to about 1,000 or so last time I was there. It appears to have grown since there's a number of new structures, more permanent structures. People really are digging in for the winter, despite the fact that it's getting colder and colder. Now, as you mentioned, there were clashes recently. Sunday night, a number of the water protectors, as they call themselves, tried to open the bridge that has been blocked off and has the bridge just north of their main Ocheti-Sakouin camp. That's the Seven Council Fires camp. They were met with a large police force who did not want them to remove the burnt-out cars that were there that the protesters were taking, trying to take off the roads to clear the road. And the police force that was there, typically it's been state police, the National Guard, and county sheriffs from as many as six different states. They responded with tear gas, non-lethal big bag rounds, pepper spray, rubber bullets, and most surprisingly, including to a number of doctors I've talked to, water. It was below 30 degrees, below freezing, and somewhere between 23 and 28 degrees late Sunday night, early Monday morning, and people were getting doused. There were a number of cases of hypothermia. I spoke with two medics today. They said they treated at least 300 people, many of them for injuries from rubber bullets, but the predominantly was the injuries from hypothermia, which can, in its worst cases, be life-threatening in situations like this. So there's a real sense of a battle going on, and I talked to a number of people who, you know, were soaked themselves. One young man, Chumash, Indian, Native American from around the Santa Barbara area, told me that he was soaked so badly that he had what looked like dreadlocks coming of ice coming out of his hair. And a number of people told me that, ironically, it had a kind of burning sensation when they were hit with water. And many of them also told me they just changed their clothes and went back. So this is ongoing, and there's nothing happening right now of this nature, but there's a pattern of confrontation that isn't going anywhere anytime soon, from what I can tell.
You said these people are calling themselves water protectors. Now, that's, of course, because the pipeline is scheduled to be dug under the Missouri River, which supplies water to the Sioux Reservation, which is just downstream. And interestingly enough, it was moved from being nearer to Bismarck, which, of course, is a major city in North Dakota. And there's a concern as to why, if it was not a good idea in Bismarck, it's okay for the Native Americans. And then there's other concern about Native lands there as well, which
right.
The tribes claim are being trespassed upon.
That's right. I mean, it's also a lot of people here will point out that it's not just about protecting their own water. If 17 million people rely on the Missouri River for their water, and many people say it's not a matter of if the pipeline is going to have leaks or spills, it's when. Of course, there's a legacy of oil spills worldwide that we can look at for that. But what's interesting to me, one of the things that to me, as someone who's covered Native issues all the way back to the early 1980s when I was in Navajo country, what's striking to me is how this has coalesced such a large collection of Native people from really around the world, but also up to 300 different tribes around the U.S. And it started really quite simply with well, not simply, but a group of maybe 300 horseback riders on April 1st rode through the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, through the snow, up to the edge of the Cannonball River. And there, a very small handful of people set up a few teepees and began collecting wood, preparing food, and praying for people to come. And lo and behold, you know, literally thousands of people answered the call, many of them native, many of them non-native. And I was struck by the fact that, that despite the fact that it's getting colder, there seem to be more people here than the last time I was here a couple of weeks ago.
Sandy Tullin, once again, author, journalist, professor at University of Southern California. Sharon Esatoya is a member of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma. She now lives in Yankton Sioux Tribal Territory in South Dakota. She's executive director of the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center. Thank you so much for being on our program today.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to join you.
Why so many people in this particular place? There have been other similar kinds of protests in the past, but nothing has attracted the kind of attention this has, and it's become a worldwide event.
Well, there's many reasons, but I think people generally are getting tired of the fossil fuel industry and how they accomplish their goal, how they've controlled the politics in the Middle East, and now they're over here and trying to control the situation, and they've recently declared war on the Great Sioux Nation, or the Oshete Shakoin, the Seven Council Fires of the Sioux Nation. Sunday they unleashed an enormous amount of militarization on unarmed people, which is not tolerable, not at all. And the previous guest was talking about the kind of force that they were using. They were also using concussion grenades, which are used in war zones. And the Morton County Sheriff has tried to deny it, but a young activist from New York City, she's from the Bronx, Sophia Wolinsky, had her arm almost blown off and is in the Hennepin County Hospital and is having reconstruction therapy, or not therapy, but surgery, and is scheduled to have several more. They're trying to save her arm from amputation.
As you pointed out, the local sheriffs have denied that they have used concussion grenades. It's thought that that's what caused the injury. Is there any indication that it might have come from somebody other than the sheriffs? Might it come from one of the protesters? Has anybody gotten that militant?
Absolutely not. We are unarmed. We were up there, in prayer, and the camp has been very, very strict about that. There are no arms. Also, the surgeons picked out, according to her father, who had done a press conference yesterday, they have picked out shrapnel, and they're using it and saving it for forensic evidence. But it is definitely a concussion grenade.
Let me quickly go back to Sandy Tullin. He needs to leave the area. I know that Jane Fonda is among the people who are scheduled to show up today, or tomorrow, rather, and serve Thanksgiving dinner to some of these protesters. Are they interested in that? Are they concerned about that? Do they want to have celebrities involved?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to. There is a number of people here who are just working to get the attention people from clergy and other people from non-Native American society who are sympathetic, and they may roll their eyes. But I think a lot of people also feel like, you know, Mark Ruffalo has been here, Jesse Jackson has been here, Shailene Woodley got arrested here. And I think, generally speaking, the people I've talked to say if this helps bring more attention to the issue, then that's just fine. I would like to pick up on something that was just said about Sophia Wolinsky. I spoke to a number of people here as well who said they personally saw concussion grenades thrown at the protesters, including one Diné or Navajo man who is a military veteran and served in three deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. He knows what those are. And I did speak with her father last night, who said he thought that the Morton County Sheriff's explanation was, in his words, utterly ridiculous.
All right, Sandy Tolan, once again, just having left the protest area in order to be able to contact us by cell phone, now going back, presumably, to that area. Tom Tseng is a professor of energy business at the University of Tulsa. Interestingly enough, he's joining us today from Scotland. Tom Tseng, thank you for being on our show. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for allowing me to.
Why do you think that this situation has developed as it has? Why did the pipeline have to be moved from near Bismarck to near the Sioux Reservation? And how important is it for the company that wants to complete the project and get the pipeline under the Missouri River?
Well, Warren, I can't answer the question about the relocation away from Bismarck. I think that's something that the people up there certainly need to get an answer to. But, you know, there's a systemic problem here. You know, again, I'm not casting ETE in this case as saints, but they did follow
ETA as the ETE rather as the company involved.
Yes, or Energy Transfer Equity.
Got it.
You know, I'm not defending their stance on this. What I'm saying is that they followed the processes that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has in place for common carrier crude oil pipelines. They filed a route, and they were given permits across that route. Obviously, you know, you mentioned, and a gentleman from California mentioned, I mean, oil disasters, people, you know about them. And certainly when the tribe found out there was an oil pipeline coming, it definitely raised concerns, especially the fact that it's, you know, going to be going under the Missouri River. From ETE standpoint, they're saying, well, we did everything we were supposed to do. And we, you know, we have the right to build it. Rerouting would be costly. Now, I know we haven't gotten to that step yet because the Corps of Engineers hasn't proposed specific routes yet to ETE. I know ETE has essentially gone to court and asked a judge to demand that the Corps, if they're going to propose new routes, that they get them to them. Now, unfortunately, I mean, Kelsey Warren, and I don't know how else to put that, he's, you know, the CEO of Energy Transfer, you know, he seems somewhat emboldened, I think, by the Trump election to where he's kind of said, you know, he's just going to build this thing. Like I said, legally, he has the right to. He supposedly has gone through, you know, all the proper steps. You know, I have concerns about a state-appointed archaeologist not finding what the tribe claims to be, you know, some type of sacred artifacts there. If they're there, that needs to be established for sure. You know, the Corps of Engineers granting right-of-way permits and then turning around and being, you know, saying, well, we need to review that now. Something went wrong in this process. You know, you have controversial natural gas pipelines in the Northeast in somewhat of a similar vein, you know, what could be deemed to be a hazardous material going through, you know, essentially someone's backyard, a bit of an exaggeration there. But those companies mostly have had, you know, town hall meetings. And so all along the route, people were notified of what was coming. And so, again, you know, my first exposure to this was reading articles where it appeared as though the tribe knew nothing about it until essentially they saw the bulldozers. Now, I don't know if that's the proper characterization, but there's something wrong with the system.
Well, apparently, as I understand it, you say that they did everything, Energy Transfer Equity did everything it was supposed to, but what it's supposed to be doing is not sufficient, according to some. They don't really require the kind of environmental studies that are the case in other places. What do you say to what we heard from Sharon Esatoya about the fossil fuel industry in general and its involvement with the environment and the fact that the Indians are the Native Americans who think of themselves as custodians of the land are just fed up with that?
Oh, I mean, I understand her her situation, or at least her thoughts on that. But the fact of the matter is it is wrong to say that they did not file the necessary environmental impact statements and environmental studies. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission requires that, plain and simple. Now, that might not be to the satisfaction of, you know, of residents in the area, but the fact is they couldn't have turned the first shovel of dirt with all that being in place.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment and apologize for that, but we need to go to a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation with our current guest. We'll have others on our program as well. And then later on our talking point, we'll talk about drug addiction and presidential politics in America's heartland. Very interesting connection between Donald Trump and the opiate addiction that is threatening so many places in the Middle West. This is To the Point from PRI.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
We're not only back with To the Point. Talk today about the extraordinary contrast between Thanksgiving, celebrated as a moment of recognizing peaceful relations between pilgrims and Native Americans, and what's happening with Native American protests out in North Dakota. We just heard a moment ago that a state hired archaeologist had, in fact, not found the kind of relics and other evidence of the importance of these lands to Native Americans. I want to go back to Sharon Asatoya on that count. What do you have to say about it?
Well, there's a couple factors here. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe filed in federal court or filed in court a notice to that fact that there were. That there were burial sites, and the next day, the Energy Transfer had their bulldozers there, and they bulldozed that whole area. That was over 20 miles from where they were the day before, and once they saw that were aware of the court documents, they knew exactly where to go, and they disturbed those sites with their bulldozers. That was the following day was the dog attack. So these guys don't go by the rules. There's no way anybody can defend them. They haven't gone by the rules at all. So that's one point. Another point is there are all kinds of graves along that way. In fact, the island right across from where the main camp is, there's been skirmishes there, and people trying to go up and lay tobacco offerings and pray. The first a woman that was a school teacher there in the Standing Rock Reservation and the only woman that signed the 1851 treaty are buried on this little island. And when they went over there to try and pay respects, they were met with water cannons and these rubber bullets. In fact, that's the day that the CNN reporter was shot while she was interviewing someone. So there is no reason for this unnecessary military force being leashed on people. Now, I'm a water protector. I go up there. I also have a job, so I come back down here to the Yankton Sioux Reservation where I live and work. I'm headed back up tomorrow, and I'll tell you, I have never seen anything like this. I'm 65 years old. I've been involved in a lot of movements in my lifetime, and I've never seen anything like this before.
Okay. I want to introduce another guest, Tom Disselhorst, who is an attorney. He has worked with several tribes. He's done this for 40 years. He teaches Indian law at the United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck, north, of course, of where we're talking about now. And Tom Disselhorst, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, sir.
What's the status of this situation? The Army Corps of Engineers is involved. There has been a halt to construction at the moment. President Obama has showed an interest in this. We've heard Tom Tseng saying from the standpoint of Energy Transfer Equity that they've done everything that they should have done. Is there any way that this can be stopped?
Well, I would take issue with the idea that they've done everything they should have done. The permit to actually put the pipeline under the river has not been granted by the Army Corps of Engineers as of yet. So that has to be granted before they can continue. There's also court proceedings. The tribe has challenged the Army Corps of Engineers' determination that there is no need for further review of the situation or the environmental situation, in part because of the tribe has said in court that the National Historic Preservation Act is involved, and the Corps did not follow all of the procedures that needed to be followed in relation to that act. And Sharon previously mentioned some issues with that. And then in addition to that, the one of the concerns about the Army Corps of Engineers granting permits here is the failure to really conduct an environmental impact statement instead of just an environmental assessment. Now, the professor from Scotland, who's from Tulsa, excuse me, might say, well, gee, they don't really need to do that under the statutes or under the laws. But in fact, they should have some kind of further review. Environmental impact statement would be the best way to do it, because then all the alternatives could be considered. And those are both the National Historic Preservation Act issues and the environmental impact statement issues under the National Environmental Policy Act are the things that are being argued in the court now. And that is presently under appeal. So to the higher court in Washington, D.C. It's going to take a little while to get all that resolved.
Let me go back to Tom Tseng again. As you indicated, University of Tulsa professor happens to be speaking to us from Scotland at the moment. You suggested, I thought, a bit earlier that in some ways the Army Corps of Engineers may have let down energy transfer equity by not crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's. And certainly if they haven't issued a permit yet, that raises a lot of questions. Tom Tseng, you with us? Apparently we have lost Tom Tseng in Scotland, so I'm sorry we can't go into that any further. Mark Trahant is with us, a journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. He blogs at Trahant Reports. He's also a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock tribe and a former president of the Native American Journalists Association. Thank you for joining us. Can you answer any of the questions about the Army Corps of Engineers, and if, in fact, energy transfer equity might, in fact, have a legitimate grievance against the Corps?
Well, the Corps certainly didn't handle this as well as they could have, not just with energy transfers, but the whole idea of consultation. They basically decided that it would mean listening to people yell at them. And the federal requirement for tribal consultation is much more comprehensive. It requires a back-and-forth exchange of ideas and alternatives, and that clearly was not done. So the Army Corps of Engineers has really made some mistakes along the way in this process. As far as the permits, they did grant one permit, but they still haven't granted the one to go under the Missouri River. And that's the one that now, and in fact, it was interesting, in one of the court proceedings, the energy transfer equity basically said, we just assumed that it would happen. And the judge said, well, you might have assumed wrong. So that process still has to unfold.
What do you know about the legal situation and the possibility that this situation, the location of digging under the river might, in fact, be changed? Are there alternatives?
There have not been alternatives proposed at this point, but I think there's going to have to be some rethinking at this down the road. One of the ways that if Army Corps of Engineers denies the permit to go under the water, and one of the issues there is what happens if there's a break when there's 30 inches of ice on top of the Missouri River. They say they can shut it down, but the in other situations with winter that severe, they haven't been able to. If you look at the question of what next, it really gets complicated, because at some point they're still going to have to cross the Missouri River, and it's not just the tribe's water, but really all of the water that flows downstream from that point.
So who's on the other side of the tribe? Who's downstream from them? They moved this away from Bismarck, but who are you talking about specifically?
Well, the next reservation downstream is the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, which has been right there as an ally of Standing Rock, saying, hey, wait, we're in the same water stream too. Then you start getting, just follow the Missouri all the way down to the Gulf, and you can see major cities along the way. As Sandy Tolan pointed out, 17 million people are downstream.
We have got Tom Tseng back on the line. Oh, we don't have him. I thought we had him briefly because I wanted to ask that question. Apparently, and Tom Disselhorst, back to you, again, our attorney who's worked with the tribes, apparently Energy Transfer Partners did start to build this pipeline, $3.7 billion project, before the easement was actually granted by the Army Corps. Obviously, that's the case because we've just heard that the permit hasn't been completed. So did, to some extent, Energy Transfer Equity bring this situation on itself?
Oh, I would think so. The consultation with the tribe did start several years ago, 2 years ago, in fact, 2.5 years ago, and the tribe really never had a full opportunity to state its case and what was the situation with the potential historic and sacred sites that were along the route that passed near the reservation. And they were startled, too, to find out that the route of the pipeline had been changed from north of Bismarck to north of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation. And really took them back to see that, oh, they were very concerned about the people of Bismarck, but not so much concerned about the people along the Missouri River. Now, if you go along the Missouri River from Standing Rock, there's five or six more tribes that are impacted by the route or by the Missouri River, because they're all along the Missouri River there, from Cheyenne River, as Mr. Trahanta indicated. The next along the line are the Clough Creek Sioux Tribe and the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, and then comes the Incan Sioux Tribe, as Sharon certainly knows. It is an amazing kind of thing that the Army Corps did 60 years ago. They built these dams that all impacted the tribes the most. And so here this relocation happens. Again, it echoes of 60 years ago when the dams were built.
Okay. Again, there's a lot of history behind all of this. We do now have Tom Tseng back on the line from Scotland. Again, our professor of energy business at the University of Tulsa. You've missed a lot of our conversation. But one of the issues that has been raised is this. Didn't Energy Transfer Equity get itself into this problem by going ahead with this massive project, $3.7 billion, without having all of the permits that were in fact needed?
Well, yeah, if that's truly the case, then sure. Then they entered into a project that, you know, yes, there would have been some of the route would have been in jeopardy. But I have to say that I think if that were the case, if they didn't have all the necessary permits for the exact route that they originally planned, number one, it's somewhat of a surprise because the federal government shouldn't have approved it if, in fact, they didn't have the route planned. Then they obviously were somewhere in there assuming some flexibility in terms of having to reroute. So, again, you know, the issue becomes, you know, to me, if you are Energy Transfer, you know, and companies are supposed to, you know, take a stance of corporate social responsibility, the question becomes, you know, what would it take to find another route? What would that cost be? You know, it's at this point in time, I mean, I think enough issues have been raised. You know, it appears as though, you know, they're saying, well, we've done everything that we were supposed to do. You know, we're not going to budge. And I don't think from a corporate standpoint, that's a very smart thing to do.
Okay. So what are the prospects then? Do you think that it is possible, particularly given that President Trump now or President-elect Trump has been chosen? You said that Energy Transfer Equity has taken heart from that. Would you look for more controversy about this, or do you think that it's likely he'll simply take the position that this should be continued? And very quickly, what's the market for this oil? Where is it going, and who's it going to be for?
Sure. On the first point, Warren, I mean, I don't know how closely, you know, Kelsey Warren, I don't even know if he knows Donald Trump, if he's met Donald Trump. Donald Trump has an oil man currently.
Apparently gave $100,000 to the Trump campaign.
Okay, well, there you go then. So they do know then, and perhaps Kelsey believes he has some type of leverage where that's concerned. One of the things about the pipeline is, and I think North Dakota themselves, they've got an issue. This is a conflict internally within the state of North Dakota, because this is the Bakken oil field oil that's going to be transported to Patoka, Illinois. And Patoka, Illinois is a large oil storage pipeline hub that feeds refineries throughout the Midwest. Currently, the oil is basically being trucked to railroad yards and being shipped by rail back to the East Coast. And of course, you know, ETE and others will tell you, I mean, pipeline transportation of oil, while not perfect, is certainly a more economic and certainly a safer situation than with the rail cars. We have had, you know, rail cars that have literally caused spills and exploded going through certain towns. Okay. So, you know, I know the issue came up about price. It's not about the price of oil. It's about the transport fee that these producers in the Bakken are willing to pay someone like ETE to get their oil more cheaply to a main market area. And in this particular case, it terminates at Patoka. Now, I know for a fact Marathon Oil is one of the shippers who has committed to shipping. Again, you can't just build this pipeline without FERC approval, and FERC will basically want you to tell them that you have companies willing to pay you so much per barrel for so many years on a set volume, because that's how these projects are financed.
Okay, and Tom Tseng, again, a professor of energy business at the University of Tulsa. I want to go back to Mark Trahant, who is our journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. This has really gotten to be a big thing. It is an international story now. There's a British poet staying at the camps, and he streamed water cannon video. That's one of the reasons we know that the spraying was done by the authorities. There, how much of a role do you think that's going to play in the decisions that are going to be made in the future?
Well, I mean, that's part of this extraordinary nature of this story, is that it's been more international than national. You've had both through social media and through The Guardian and Vice and BBC, a presence from international press from the very beginning. Sandy Tolan and Jenny Monet and a few other people have done some really excellent work. But the press in general, today's New York Times editorial is another good one, but it's not been like a television story. Like when the Oregon takeover occurred, CNN was nonstop, and there's no satellite trucks at Standing Rock. There's none of the same national presence that would make this a compelling story. When you began, you started by talking about Thanksgiving. And this really is extraordinary that at this moment, after two centuries of living together, the misunderstanding between Native people and the American public is this great a divide. And it's partly because the press isn't telling these stories about how every tribe in the country has a Standing Rock. They can point to every company coming in, promising that the water will stay clean, and then having it not be, and then leaving. And that is just built up over two centuries where folks are saying, I'm not going to take this anymore. This is where it stops.
Sharon Esatoya, we just have a couple of seconds left, but are you banking on President Obama in this regard? Do you think there's anything he can do or should do between now and the time he leaves?
He needs to stop the violence, and he has the power to do it. Another thing, that oil is not intended for domestic market. It's going, once it hits Illinois, going down to the Gulf, and then it's going to China and Southeast Asia. So let's get it straight. Nobody's going to benefit in this country from that oil except for the one percenters.
All right. We're going to have to end the program here. I want to thank all of you very much for being on our program. A very complex situation, and all of you are obviously deeply involved. Sharon Esatoya, once again, with the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma, now living in Sioux Territory in South Dakota. Mark Trahant, a journalist at the University of North Carolina, a member of the Idaho Shoshone-Bannock tribe. Tom Disselhoff, an attorney who has worked with several tribes for 40 years. Tom Tseng, professor of the energy business at the University of Tulsa, and our earlier guest, Sandy Tolan, mentioned a moment ago by Mark Trahant, author, journalist, and professor at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism. He is on the scene there today. In a moment, drug addiction and presidential politics in America's heartland. We'll hear all about that on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Well, and only back with today's talking point. Sam Quinones wrote a book a couple of years ago called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. After he finished his book tour to America cities, where publishers think the book public really lies, he began getting calls from parts of the country where authors never go. When he went to those places, he discovered that there was major support for Donald Trump's campaign for a president. Sam Quinones, thanks very much for joining our program.
Thanks very much for having me, Warren.
Tell us where you were going, what states, what cities, what parts of the country, and what evidence of the campaign did you see?
I was going to areas where the opiate epidemic was felt most intensely. Southern Illinois, Southern Indiana, parts of Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, places like this, Heartland, rural areas, Rust Belt areas, and particularly as the spring turned to fall, you could see a shift. You could see in the lawn signs, the yard signs, everywhere, Trump, Pence signs everywhere. I saw very few Hillary Clinton signs the whole time I was doing this. But this to me was a sign that where I was an area affected by mightily, of course, by the opiate epidemic, by addiction to pills, pain pills, and heroin, but also that those areas were now turning, perhaps in large part because of that, to Donald Trump as the campaign progressed.
Now, these are places where unemployment has been lower than in the recent past.
It's been going down. The figures have been going down. So it's you find places where it's 4 to 6 to 7% unemployment rate, where it used to be 10 to 14 to 18 percent. But I think hidden within that is a kind of a dimmer kind of story, where a lot of people are not able to actually participate in the workforce because they're too strung out. I met several people, county officials, economic development folks, mayors, and so on, chamber of commerce folks, who would tell me, you know, half the people who apply for a job can't pass a drug screen. 70% in several areas, I found 70% of the people can't pass a drug screen, who we get applicants for jobs and so on. And I began to think, imagine what that does to a county's productivity, for its prospects for economic progress and development, as well as its own kind of, you know, buoyancy of spirit. If you have people all around you who are strung out, who are doped up, who are addicted, and they can't pass, so much so that they can't pass a drug screen, what does that mean for the feeling of the town, the optimism of the town? Opiate addiction tends to bring with it a real fog, of negativity, of inertia, of kind of hopelessness. And I think in large degree, that was what drove a lot of people to Donald Trump. Those economic figures and unemployment figures were not signs of optimism. They created more foreboding than optimism, really.
You talk about kids, children of pastors and cops and mayors and star athletes, young people with no criminal records at all.
Right, yes. So my blog post, exactly, I talk about how families that expected a rosier life for their kids when their kids were born, by the time those kids are now 20, 22, 24 years old, they are calling their mom, collect from jail. There's conniving. There's stealing precious jewelry or plates or something from grandma. You know, all across the board, you get people addicted, all across the economic spectrum. And this, too, brings with it a kind of a feeling like things are really not headed in the right direction. This is a negative thing for our town. It doesn't have to be that a ton of people get addicted for this fog of negativity, this kind of opiate fog, to be created in a town. A few cases, a few kids dying, a few people saying, yeah, that guy used to be the quarterback on the team. It doesn't take a lot for that feeling to kind of spread in a town.
In your book, you talk about how this all began with the overprescription of opiates by doctors, by the marketing of opiates by Big Pharma, and the addiction then of people who can no longer afford to buy those substances, and so they turn to cheap Mexican heroin. How did those things relate to Donald Trump's issues?
On the former, really, I think what it did was turn people away from some of the sacred cows of the Republican Party, that the elites of the Republican Party had been promoting: free trade, big business, kind of a corporate view of America, because corporations were really behind this trade. This is a story of the private sector creating a drug scourge that has mightily affected middle America, heartland America, Rust Belt America. And I think that soured people on a lot of those traditional Republican talking points of free trade, of lower taxes for corporations and that kind of thing. And at the same time, people began to understand that a lot of the heroin that they were getting was coming in cheap from Mexico. And this also soured them on Mexico. They had lost factories to Mexico, and now they were losing kids, their own kids, to Mexico. This, I think, played some role in Trump's populist appeal. He went away from what the Republican elites have been talking about, the conservative think tanks have been talking about for 35 years, really, or more.
But these have been Democratic areas for many years in the past. Why did people blame the Obama administration?
Now, that's a very good question. I think because their lives really, despite the falling unemployment rates, people still had not fully felt a recovery because a lot of people around them were not employable, because a lot of news around them was about dope, was about this very negative, unsettling thing that they were not prepared for. Because of all these factors, I think they did not view what have been pretty good economic figures nationally and, in fact, locally as signs as positive signs forward. They viewed them more as not really as good as people were saying. And the proof is all around us, because all around us are people whose lives are being stunted and mangled by pill and now heroin addiction.
What do you think they anticipate, or what do they expect, and what are they likely to demand from the Trump administration?
Wow, that is a really, really good question. And, the Trump administration ran on repealing Obamacare. Obamacare has within it, to states that opt into this part of it, it covers addiction treatment. Are people in those areas, and is a Chamber of Commerce director going to support repealing Obamacare if 70% of the people in her county can't pass a drug screen because they're too addicted? I don't know. I think this is a wild card, really. And Donald Trump didn't really talk about addiction services or treatment services to any great degree that I heard anyway during the campaign. And so he may be like a wild card himself. He may go whichever way he's pushed. I suspect that may be what in fact happens. And so I suspect it's up to people in those areas to make themselves heard on this. But the truth is, I have no idea, nor frankly do I think many people in those areas have a clue what he's going to do on this topic, just reading Facebook posts and comments here and there. I don't think anybody in those areas really has a clue what he's going to do about treatment services, because he simply hasn't talked about that topic at all.
Okay. The book, once again, is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam Quinones wrote it some time ago. He is still talking about it now in those areas of the country that he just told us about. Sam Quinones, thanks so much for being on our program.
Oh, my pleasure, Warren. Thank you.
You can read more about this subject and others on Sam Quinones' blog at samquinones.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.